The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is part two of my Stratus extravaganza. Thrilled to be sitting with head winemaker, Dean Stoika. Dean, thanks so much for being on the pod today.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew, for having me on. It's been a pleasure to come on.
Again, a huge admirer of the work that's done here and the work that you guys are doing. But I'm going to start in a very different direction. How much fun did you have on go-karts in Tokyo?
Oh, I mean, that's one of the coolest experiences you can do in life. I heard they're bringing it to Toronto, actually, so that's going to be probably drive everyone crazy in Toronto because the traffic's already nuts. But man, oh man, what an experience and what a great way to see the city.
It is. I did it this past September.
Oh, you did?
I saw your Instagram account. Now we're going way off topic. There's no fucking way you could do this in Toronto. The whole time when we were driving in Tokyo, we were thinking, we couldn't do this in Toronto.
Now the traffic crazy is going to try.
Could you imagine Eglinton, Spadina, any of those streets doing that?
Well, and people in Japan are so, they're so respectful.
Yes.
And so you're kind of like, well, one, I didn't sign a waiver and I didn't wear a helmet, which kind of was like, wow, that's surprising because I got up to 70 kilometers an hour on this go-kart. You could never do that in Toronto or in Canada. You would have to sign over your life to do it. But the drivers driving around you, it's like they're so respectful of you. It's unusual, so hard to imagine.
As I said, I love Canada. I won the geographical lottery being born here, but Japan's better. They're just far nicer.
So polite.
Yeah, I didn't hear one horn honked in my 2.5 weeks in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. You won't hear it. Doesn't happen. I don't even know if they have horns in the cars. They probably don't need them.
Yeah. The interesting thing about the two of you guys, with you and JL, is you both come from very different backgrounds in terms of where you were born and stuff, but you kind of have very similar origin stories where both of you, your father certainly played an impact in your love of wine.
Yeah, I think, JL definitely being a Loire Valley native and his father's impact on him getting into wine influenced so much of his curiosity in life and his experimentation. And then my father being in the Niagara wine industry, when I grew up, it's almost like I didn't know what else you could do for a job, to be honest with you. Like, my dad started in 1978. He was in high school, and he worked there for 42 years at Bright's Wines, which then became Vincor. And in my household, it was like the wine industry is kind of all there is.
And then for you, when did you first start to fall in love with wine?
Oh, in high school. I was that kid who everyone was showing up with, Grey Goose or, whatever drinks in high school party, and I would come with a Cab Merlot. And so people were like, what's this guy doing with this Cab Merlot at the party, looking for a wine glass in their parents' pantry?
That's funny. So everyone's got either the really bad coolers, the beer, or just the vodka, and you come in with a Niagara
with
Cab
like
Merlot.
A Delaine Vineyard Cab Merlot or something, or a Syrah, and people were like, where is it? My dad once said he didn't mind me and my brother, taking a bottle of wine out of his cellar, that we would sneak him out, but he just minded that we had such expensive taste.
Right.
Because we were always looking for the gold label, the fancy label, it was like probably almost like researching consumer behavior when I was like 15. I was like, oh, that looks like a cool label. I'm gonna drink that one. It would always be the best wine.
Do you have any memories from your dad where he got really pissed off? Do you know, was there a specific bottle where your dad was like, you opened that? You have all these wines. You opened that wine?
You know what? It happened a few times. I that's why I was saying the Delaine Vineyard. I remember one time, I'm pretty sure it was the Delaine Vineyard. I remember the label having some gold on the label. I was probably in grade 11, and I think I took two bottles. And the thing about my dad, he's not a huge wine drinker, but he had tons of these wines in his cellar. And also, I would know about age. So I would never take like a 2 or 3 year old wine. I'd take like the 10 year old wine. I was like, oh, this is going to taste good. Not realizing the value, not realizing, he's been saving this thing for 10 years now. It definitely drove him nuts. But that's where I got my sort of start into wine. And as a kid, my dad played on like the hockey team, the baseball team, back when companies used to have like intramural sports. And it was a common thing. They'd all go back and have drinks at the winery, and all of us kids would kind of play hide and go seek in the cellars. It was the 90s. The health and safety, I don't think, was invented yet in Canada.
Oh my God. What better place to hide and seek as a kid that had a winery?
Yeah, that was like I remember my brother getting stung by a bee outside the back of where Arteria is now in Niagara Falls, like the hang around the wine tanks, and a bee stung him. That was my first experience that if you're at a crush pad, there's going to be bees, because it was him when he was about 11.
And now I'm bouncing all over the place. I was going to do more of your origin story. What are the sneaky dangerous things about making wine, about being in the vineyard that people may not know?
Ooh, well, I mean, CO2 is that one thing. Probably, I think a lot of people know about that. But heights, you know, we you know, you see this winery, it's got tall ceilings. We're always working on ladders. You take for granted when you're standing on a ladder and you do it. If you work in a place and you're climbing a ladder 1,000 times a day, you get used to it and you just forget that there's a danger to that. And then you kind of, that one time your mind forgets about it and boom, down you go. So yeah. Heights, working on ladders and trips, that's big in the wine.
Yeah.
Ice wine on the floor, ice wine juice, ice wine harvest, the juice gets on the ground. And somebody walks by that 10 minutes later, that can take you out quite quickly too.
Because so it's frozen and ice.
It's super slippery too.
Yeah.
It's like super high sugar. So you get that on the right. cellar floor during pressing and then walk by, you know, an hour later and you forgot you spilled some ice wine on the ground. That can take you down and put you out for a while.
Did you ever have to work an ice wine harvest?
Have I worked an ice wine harvest before Stratus, you mean?
Yeah, at any time in your life, because that one always seems the hardest when it's late at night and everyone's freezing.
Yeah, well, we pick ice wine usually every year, and I normally pull a little cod out and I stay the night at the winery because it's such a, you know, I almost can't think of a time at Stratus that I've done an ice wine harvest where I didn't do a 24-hour shift, basically.
Really?
Like, it's just, it's your go. You're picking right into pressing. There's no time. There's no, you know, you can pick Chardonnay grapes and you can put them in a cold cellar overnight. You can mosey around, take your time, grab your coffee. Ice wine is like, pick it right there and get it right in the press as fast as you can and keep pressing and don't stop until you've made the ice wine.
There's obviously tons of different examples when you feel pressure like anyone does in their job. But the ice wine harvest, I would imagine, is that near the top of the list?
Oh, yeah, that's up there. Especially because you want to make sure you get it right. The temperature, there's a lot of house style. So, you know, people think ice wine is so simple. Just wait for it to get to -8 and you're going to make ice wine. But there's temperature, there's waiting for the wind to change. Because we like to go pick on our very first opportunity at -8. Some people like a freeze thaw, so they're maybe not as stressed as we are. But as soon as it hits -8, we want to pick. And sometimes it's hovering -7.8. You can't, if you pick at -7.8, you don't get the bricks. You won't make ice wine. Even 7.9, you got to be at -8, and between -8.9 is a sweet spot for us. So you're kind of winemaking on the edge. And all it takes is a, you know, slight change in the wind. If the wind goes from north of the lake and it starts switching from west to north, so the wind's getting warmed as it goes over the lake, you might miss your window for picking ice wine that night.
Jesus, that must be, you're just all there staring at the thermometer.
One night I sat in my car and I hit reset on the weather app and we were in there for 5 hours, and then you know what? It didn't ever happen. We had to call it off. We sat in our cars for 5 hours and ice wine. It got to 7.9 and we never hit -8.
Do you ever stare at the bottles of ice wine and just look at it and go, you asshole? Like, what you did to me that day.
Yeah. Well, I do until I drink it, and then I'm so happy that we did it, right? That's the,
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the beauty about ice wine. I'm a big proponent of ice wine in Niagara. It's something that we can do in Niagara every year. It's special to our industry. I love the, it's like an exciting, it's like a Super Bowl for us, you know, when we pick ice wine. There's a lot of excitement, anticipation. You're nervous. You know, everything has to go right to be able to win this experience. And when you're done the process, you have this amazing product that we, you know, what a better time than right now to say it's, you know, simply Canadian.
No, yeah. It's such an incredibly impressive product because it is so hard to make. And it consistently, when done well, tastes fantastic. Is there a double-edged sword with it? Just with when you're convincing the rest of the world that Canada, it makes, and Ontario, Niagara, we can make these beautiful Bordeaux blend styles that have other grapes in them as well. Because a lot of people are like, oh yeah, Canada. Oh yeah, you guys are the ones who make the ice wine.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think there's enough room for a dedicated dessert wine category and for our table wines. Many regions in the world do both, and they make their dry wines and they also do, they're drying the grapes on the vine or they dry them in a kiln and they make sweet wines that way. You know, you have Bordeaux, you have Sauternes, and then you have the rest of Bordeaux. Sure, there's a separation maybe of the slight regions, but you're all in the, you know, commune of Bordeaux when you're doing that.
Yeah.
So I think there's enough room for us to be able to say we do ice wine and we have this really cool dessert wine, but we also do amazing Chardonnay and amazing Riesling and amazing Cab Franc or Bordeaux blends.
We'll get to Stratus in a second, but in a lot of ways, like, you were almost designed for this job. As you mentioned, your father, and then you drinking wine at high school parties, and then when you were in school, you were all about like chemistry and biology. That screams the bio of someone who's going to be a future winemaker.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I went to school for winemaking. And then when I walked through the doors of Stratus, I saw also at Stratus so much more than just winemaking. It was almost a lifestyle. You walk in, you see the design, architecture, the art on the walls, everything. So that was what, you know, I always loved science, and I didn't know if I wanted to be a dietitian or if I wanted to be a winemaker. So I went to winemaking school, and I was like, okay, this is working for me. I could definitely be a winemaker. And then you walk into the beautiful estates, one like Stratus, and you're like, okay, there's winemaking, but there's handmade, there's design, there's all these other things. And I've always loved that. I love things that are well made and well done. And so wine not only speaks to my curious scientific side, but also my artistic side, that you're working on a team and creating something.
And that was back in 2010 when you first started working here?
2010. My first year at Niagara College, I went for a year of health science, and then my first year at Niagara College was 2009. So that was my first like school vintage, which was a challenging one, nice and cool year. And then 2010, I did an interview with JL right around, it was about March, mm-hmm. that we did the interview for the 2010 harvest.
What were your first impressions of JL?
Ah, he was, you know, I thought, what a brilliant person JL is. He can really speak to people in a down-to-earth way, but with a lot of knowledge. And what really impressed me is we went straight out into the vineyard right here that we can see from this room. We did a tour of the whole winery first, which was great. And we talked about micro-ox, and we talked about roto-fermenters that we use for whites, and all this technological advancement and gravity flow and everything that we've built this amazing facility for. But afterwards, he takes me in the vineyard, and he's like, you know, kind of forget all that bullshit that you saw fancy in there. You know, we don't even need that. What's the most important thing is the best wines made in the vineyard. And in 2010, that's the first time I ever heard that. You know, in winemaking school, kind of around that time, there's a lot of famous winemakers. You know, you had Michel Roland's the world and the Paul Hobbs and all that kind of stuff. A lot of the focus was on fame of winemakers. And even in school, there was a bit of a sense like, you're the winemaker, it's going to be about you, and you got to do this to the wine, and you're making the wine. And I go out there, and for the first time, I hear a winemaker saying like, that's actually not about me or about the facility or any of that kind of stuff. What I do out here is my most important part. And I never heard that before. And mm-hmm. right away, I'm like, I have to work. I gotta learn from this person. Like, what? This is now every winemaker says that. You go in any winery, we're all gonna say wine's made in the vineyard. This is like a catchphrase.
It is.
But in 2010, it wasn't. At least I hadn't heard it. Anyways.
Yeah.
And that was a new concept. So JL was the first to ever bring that to me, and I knew right away. Like, okay, well now there's another piece I gotta learn, which is the vineyard.
And one of the pieces of advice he gave you was to learn everything, like to really just. You know, it'd be nice if your job was just to be out in the vineyards, tasting the grapes, and then, you know, and being right there on in terms of the blending. But for his advice was, you got to learn to nail all the stuff, even the unromantic stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. JL set out a vision for me that I have to admit, even I didn't have. He kind of knew the vision to becoming a winemaker. And when I was young, like any young person, you have a lot of excitement and you want to be here, you want to be there. You're sort of all over the place. You're like a puppy. And JL was really good at sort of restraining me and putting focus, exactly as you said, like, let's master this area and then we'll move on to this area. And then we'll, you know, do the lab and then master the winemaking, the cellars, and master the barrel cellar, and then do the vineyard, and then come back and we'll start putting that all together. And so that was a vision he had that, you know, he probably shared to me, but I never really listened. And I didn't know where we were going. What, you know, I just was like, okay. He's like, next, you're going to learn this.
How like, old were you? Sorry to interrupt.
Well, in 2010, I was 21.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I had just turned 21. So, yeah. I came here at just after my 21st birthday. So, yeah, young and just no knowledge of what's coming at me.
You know what it reminds me of? And I have to, because, you know, there's certainly a gap in years between you and I. Have you seen The Karate Kid?
Yeah. Course.
Okay, so he was Mr. Miyagi, you were Daniel's son. You wanted to go and kick ass and learn how to do karate and knock someone down. He's like, paint the fence and wax the car.
Yeah. You know what? It's a great analogy. And film always have these great analogies like that, where it's like somebody's been through that in life, and so they made a movie about it. And the underlying story is that one of mentorship, one of somebody who wants to do everything and has no idea where to put all their energy, and then the mentor saying, if I can just contain this person's energy and put them in each place, they'll master it, and then you eventually become a mentor.
Half a decade later, you got the role of vineyard manager. What were those days like?
Well, it was a different kind of stress. That was the first time in my entire life I ever felt adversity, real adversity, just because there was so much responsibility. And that was the moment where it was 2015 is when I became the vineyard manager. And that was the first year where I understood everything JL had always been saying. And, you know, up until then, we probably butted heads a lot. And then 2015 came and you have all this responsibility. And I went through what's known as imposter syndrome in that first year.
Right.
You're 25 years old and you're managing a vineyard at this level for this kind of quality of wine. And JL's kind of like, you know, you've been coming along, like it's yours now. Like go out there and take a year. I think he had great advice. He said, because he knew me, he knew my mentality, don't try and change everything at once. Take a year, see what's going on, come up with your formulas, your concepts, and then we'll start making changes. So that was a great advice he gave me. But that first year was the first time in my life I ever was like, can I truly accomplish this? Can I achieve this? There was a challenging time. I was in charge of a team and there's adversity of the vineyard. There was times where the vineyard looked kind of like crap and you put it all on yourself. I never in my life, up until then, it was all confidence. And every person in the world needs to go through that. That's a it's a barrier you need to break through. And so 25, I can confidently say at 25 years old, I had to break through the barrier of this imposter syndrome before I thought I had confidence, and then I went through no confidence, and I came out being like, okay, now I can tackle anything.
It's also the pressure of responsibility. I mean, this is a place that, you know, by 2015, this place has been around for 10 years, making these big quality wines, expensive wines. It has a reputation. And now here you are at 25, walking through the most important thing, which has nothing to do with oak or anything else. It's about, you know, it's about the vines out there.
Yeah. And the way it looks and feels kind of is a reflection on your leadership. So at least that's what I was thinking back then. So if a block kind of looked ugly and the weeds were getting out and the vines were starting to get a little gnarly, you know, it hurt because you were like, this is my responsibility. It can't look like this. And, you know, most growers, when I was 25, most growers were in their 60s and 70s. I would go to growers meetings. You're kind of like the young buck. And there was people kind of at the time being like, man, that winery, they must be desperate. Like,
right.
What were they thinking hiring this 25-year-old kid to be the vineyard manager? But JL had confidence in me. And so I have to give him kudos that anyone would try that with a 25-year-old to give them that much responsibility. But he believed that, you know, I was up to the task.
That must have helped with some of your coworkers because, you know, everyone's human. There could be people that are going, wait, why did he get that job? Maybe I want that job. I've been here longer. I should be doing it. But at least knowing that you had the blessing of JL probably put a little bit of an umbrella against some of the very human emotions of maybe some jealousy or resentment.
Yeah, I mean, being a young leader is always going to be a challenge. And I would advise, you know, what I did at the time was look into a lot of leadership books. JL was actually a proponent of like getting some leadership training and stuff, because when you're 25, you have to face that. You're going to face people who are older, who've been doing it longer, who probably don't always understand the decision making of how maybe they were passed over and things like that. But a good leader can usually bring those people into your ethos, and sort of by actions and working hard and doing what you do, you actually convince them and they start to say, you know what, I still want to be a leader, but that person, I can follow their leadership. And then ideally they work on whatever they maybe were missing, and then they achieve it by that guidance as well. And I think that's sort of how it went. We never really had any blowups from the team or anything like that. It was a pretty seamless sort of thing. You know, obviously there's always some challenges, but it was well done.
What does a good looking vineyard look like for Dean?
Oh, well, it's definitely changed. You know, when I was young, it was trying to be pristine and perfect. And then you start to learn things and you travel the world and you see that a vineyard is a living organism. You know, if every day you had to try and make your hair look perfect and your makeup look perfect and your body look perfect and you were always focusing on that, there's an unhealthy aspect to that and it's unattainable. And so the vineyard, I see that same reflection is in people as I see in the vineyard. You know, there's the fundamentals that need to be followed, but there's many different battles going on in a growing season, and you have to pick which ones are most important to win, and the ones that you can say, I can let that go and come back and fight another day. And so if you don't get preoccupied and carried away in your vineyard management skills, my vineyard, the perfect vineyard looking to me is one that's got good biodiversity, good growth, but also a lot of other things going on, a lot of little weeds growing by the vines and all that kind of stuff going on. Some people would say, never, I don't want any of that. That actually makes me excited when I see that, because I know what's below the soil is thriving with what's right. growing above the soil. So I try and see it from that aspect.
What are the toughest battles? What are the toughest battles out there?
You're facing Mother Nature. I commonly say that managing a vineyard is like a coach would manage a football season. So you have 16 weeks in a football season, now 17. In a growing season, you have the same kind of thing. You're going to have, you know, 16 weeks. You have your spring, your summer, and your fall coming. every football coach starts out the year thinking they're going to go 16-0 and then go to the playoffs and then win the Super Bowl. And by game three, you might be an 0-3. And the season starts out like that. You start off the year thinking it's going to be a perfect year. You're going to go 16-0. And by end of May, the weeds are out of control. It's rained like crazy. You haven't been able to get the tractors in the field. You're behind. And so that's where the adversity comes in. You followed a plan, but now you have to start making slight changes to your plan. And that's the idea of the best vineyard managers and the best football coaches. The adjustments they make, these small adjustments they make, is what leads you to having a successful full season. And then you might not have went 16-0. You might go, I don't know, 11-5.
Perfectly good record. I'm a fan of the New York Giants. They've won Super Bowls with less than that.
There you go. And then you're into the growing season, which is the playoffs. And all the decisions you did in the growing season are going to impact how well you can do in the growing season. So the challenges that happen there is really, you know, all these weeks in, weeks out, there's growth happening. If you get too far behind, you know, you can't catch up eventually. So if you're 0-10, you're not going to the playoffs. So if you can't keep up with the weather, you can't keep up with the leaf removal, the spraying, and all that kind of stuff, and you keep losing these battles, eventually you start to lose a vineyard. And now you're looking into major either changes or, you know, and you never want to, no vineyard manager wants to get to that, but it can happen. And so the good vineyard managers start with a plan, and the plan's never going to go according to your plan perfectly. So you can make slight minor adjustments to that plan. And then throughout the season, you start coming, bringing it back, winning that battle. You catch up on the weeds, you get the leaves off, you get the sprays caught up, and then now you're back into the mix of it.
We'll stay with this analogy for 1 second longer. Would losing your starting quarterback to a season-ending injury, is that the equivalent to flash frost around May 2-4?
Yeah, exactly. There's some things you just can't control, right?
Yeah.
Right from the beginning of the season, now you're going to be playing the rest of the season on catch-up. So if something like that, frost can be a big one, hail, you know, these weather-like events, just like a football team, you can't control what's going to happen to your quarterback out there on the field. You can't control what Mother Nature is going to throw at you. You can still do curative stuff after, so you're going to have a backup quarterback. There's going to be things to go, you know, obviously if you have a frost that knocks out everything, there's no coming back other than maintaining and managing new vines. So we think about growing a vineyard as just growing these grapes every year, but you're not really even growing grapes, you're growing vines. You're managing the health and life of a vine that's going to last 50 years, 100 years. And so you might have these years just like your quarterback. They have to have an off year. We had that in 2022. And so, but you're going to manage your quarterback after that. You got to manage the health of that vine, reinvigorate that vine, retrain that vine so that you can have many more seasons of happiness and growth from that vine. So it's a long-term plan. A vineyard season is one season, but we usually think in decades at Stratus. JL's been farming this land for 2.5 decades. I've been here for a decade and a half. And we very rarely talk about what's happening today or tomorrow or even this harvest. A lot of our planning is talking about where we want to be in 2028, 2029, in terms of vineyard mix, vineyard health, and sustainability.
How much do you enjoy the blending aspect of it?
Oh, I love that. That's the art of it. That was the major mentorship that I wanted to learn from JL. We went in the vineyard. We talked about, you know, wine is made in the vineyard. But there is this idea of the art of assemblage that's passed down from generation to generation of winemaker. And you know, you're not born knowing these skills. You learn these skills over years and years and years, and somebody ideally knowing what they're doing, showing you how to do it. And so I love this idea of playing with different varieties, different textures and structures, aromas, flavors, to try and make this all-encompassing wine that comes together as a perfect piece. It's so much fun. And it's a challenge. Like we're working on the process right now. After this meeting, we're going to go up and do a Art of Assemblage tasting. We're getting close to the end for the 23 reds and the 24 whites. And you feel like there's teamwork going on. We have our wine growing manager in the tasting, the assistant winemaker, me, JL. And so we're all bringing these different skill sets that we know about the wines, because the assistant winemaker's day-to-day in the barrels. The wine growing manager's day-to-day in the vineyard. I'm overseeing the whole thing, and JL obviously has all these years of experience knowing what he's tasting. And so we come together as a team and we make this perfect product together. It's the best part of the job.
The nerdy question, and just a couple things, what they bring to the blend, like we'll just go with the basic ones: Cab Franc, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, maybe Petit Verdot as well. What do each one of those brings to the fine? Like, what are you looking for for each one of those?
Well, I think one thing is we have so much vintage variation in Niagara, it's changing from year to year. So there's years where Petit Verdot is playing a 2-5% impact in the wine, and there's years where it's an 18% impact in the wine. And that just speaks to the vintage variation we have in Niagara. It's a really robust grape, and it does well if it's a rainier season. So if you need some structure and color and tannin intensity, well, in a more challenging year like 2018 or 2021, you can use that as a tool in your wine to really bump up the wine. If you have a year like 2020, where it's an incredible year, and Cab Franc, Cab Sauv, and Merlot are all incredible in that year, well, PV doesn't need to be a show horse that time. It takes a sort of a backstage role, because those other varieties really show in terms of floral and black fruit, red fruit. So, and Merlot bringing this really soft, silky tannin structure. So in the great years, those wines can go there, and you're really just trying to guide a wine into place. And so if it's Merlot, I really celebrate Merlot for its mouthfeel. One time a friend of mine who's a winemaker in France mentioned me, you know, like to Michel Roland, his thing is always like more Merlot. Mm-hmm. When they're doing the blend, because I guess he knows, you know, that the structure, people maybe think they don't like Merlot, and there's, you know, the movie, and Merlot really,
think about how old that movie is.
Yeah, and it's still going
20 years. That movie's like 20 years old.
Yeah, so people, there's a thing about the term Merlot, and people have maybe a negative opinion of Merlot, but it's completely misguided, and they, people will go and drink, you know, Right Bank, Saint Emilion, or Pomerol, and say, I don't like Merlot, and then you say, well, that's a Merlot, and they go, oh yeah, no way. So Merlot, it's got great mouthfeel, so I'll look for that. And then the aromas, and Cab Sauv, again, in its own right, you know, the tannins, when you have a good year, like 2020 or 2022 or 24, the silkiness, like, it's hard to compete with how amazing Cab Sauv can be. And those years, typically, Cab Sauv might actually be the dominant grape variety in a Stratus blend, the warmest, hottest years, because it just shows so well. And then Cab Franc is Mr. Consistent. It's every year, year in, year out, it's making a great wine. So that was what we have mostly planted in our vineyard. And I'll throw that, you know, variety as adding complexity. You get floral aromas, you get the cherry, you get the red fruit, but it also has great mouthfeel.
By the way, at the end of Sideways, Paul Giamatti's drinking Cheval Blanc. That's a Merlot dominant blend.
Yeah, yeah. That's the whole point of the movie. That's the best.
Yeah.
It actually speaks to the whole story of Merlot.
Yeah, yeah, it really does. How different is your approach and the winemaking approach for the, you know, for the single varietals? Because I mean, when I think of Stratus first, obviously I do think of the blends, but you have a Cab Franc, you have Merlot, you have Cabernet Sauvignon that are all just, you know, 100% of that grape.
Yeah.
What's sort of the different approach?
Well, the one secret sauce to Stratus that so many people don't know is most of our wines are still blends. So even a Cab Franc or a Merlot at Stratus,
okay, so what's
typically a blend,
right,
of, you know, we have 15 blocks of Cab Franc and we vinify them all separately, and we do them in amphora, we do them in large format oak, we do them in small format oak, we ferment them in barrels, we do stainless steel, we do all these different styles. And there's a few wines that you can truly say are individual block wines. That typically tends to be our white label series, mm-hmm, where they come from the very best block of a certain grape from our vineyard in any given year. But most other wines at Stratus are a blend of different blocks, different winemaking techniques that we're doing throughout the year. And then, so when we're working on the Art of Assemblage right now, a lot of people think we're just tasting Stratus Red and Stratus White, when in fact we're doing Merlot, like we're making 23 wines this August. We're going to bottle 23 different wines. Almost every single one of them is in its own right some kind of blend. The Cab Franc is a blend of different blocks, different styles, different clones.
Right.
The Merlot and all that. So that's maybe, you know, the interesting thing about Stratus is we're always looking to get the best out of our wines. And so to just take one block of Cab Franc, sometimes that can make an exceptional wine, but not every year. The best is coming out where you're saying, let's take a little bit of CF4 and a little bit of CF5 and a little bit of CF13. One thing to know about Niagara is their glacial till soils. So we have four soil types on this property right here. And it drastically changes. Where we are here, there's more silt and a little bit of clay. And if you make your way out towards the east of the vineyard, there used to be a river that run through there. And so it's all gravel and rock, limestone, granite. It's very stony out in that area of the vineyard. So it's completely different if you grow Cab Franc out there than if you grow Cab Franc to right where we're sitting over here. And the flavors and styles of that Cab Franc are completely different. So when you put those into a blend, that makes an exciting wine too.
Jesus, yeah, that's you're juggling so much there.
So, well,
yeah, it's so then what's the determining factor for the, as you said, the white label? So that is that typically going to be just one grape from one vineyard?
Typically, so yeah, all from the Stratus vineyard. So everything we make at Stratus, we typically grow on our site. We have many different clones, root stocks, and soil types that of the same variety that we grow. So typically the white label is an individual micro parcel of our vineyard that we know year in, year out, in the best years, consistently makes an exceptional wine from our vineyard. So the white label Cab Sauv is Cab Sauv 3, which is just out there. And it's from a particular section of Cab Sauv 3 that we pick separately. We pick everything by hand. So if we were picking by machine, it would be almost impossible to do, but we pick by hand. So we can say from that end post, that wind machine, to that pile of vines over there, let's pick that, and that's the best spot. So this was 25 years of, the first time we ever did it was 2020, the first okay. vintage of white label Stratus. And it was 20 years of JL and then me vinifying all different sections of this vineyard. Like I'm telling you, it's thousands of fermentations and books this thick of R&D in terms of what is the best parts of our vineyard. And so white label is 2020 is the first time we could confidently say the white label Merlot is from ME3, a certain section of ME3. The white label Cab Sauv is from a certain section of Cab Sauv 3. And then the white label red is a blend from these special parcels that we've vinified. And in a special process where we take only a certain amount part of the free run to make that wine. So that's how the white label series goes. Then you have the amphoras, which are also white label wines, but they're vinified in amphora. We go and take what we would think the most expressive of Cab Franc or Chardonnay from our vineyard is, and we ferment those individual parcels in amphora.
How much fun is it working with the amphora, just from a wine geekery standpoint?
Oh, I love it. It's a whole other, you know.
Also, could you explain to the listeners, sorry, that don't know just the... what the amphora is?
Yeah, so amphora is a earthenware vessel, so some winemaking vessel made out of clay typically, but they can be made of sandstone. They can, you know, you could even consider concrete probably in the same category, but they differ slightly. So you make wine in them, and they allow oxygen through the pores, so they're porous, these vessels, just like oak, but they don't give any flavor like oak does, or any aroma like oak does, or any tannin like oak does. So they have one function that works similarly to oak, but then they're also very different from making wine in oak. And so you really get a whole different way of making wine when you start making wine in amphora versus in oak, and you think about things differently as well. And then in amphora themselves, well, this is also an art. So there's different baking temperatures, there's different materials, there's different shapes. So that impacts all these special ways of making amphora, also change the way the wine tastes when you ferment it or age it in the amphora.
Other geeky sort of wine question, but this one coincides with price, which another theme I always try to do. People that listen, they're getting tired of me hearing this about why, you know, spending $60, $70, $80, $90, whatever, over $100 for one of your wines is actually a very reasonable price. When it comes to your yields, the techniques in the vineyard and the money you spend in the winery, how similar is it to a growth Bordeaux?
Well, you know, I'm studying for my WSET 4 right now.
Oh, you're doing the diploma?
I'm doing the diploma. I'm doing my exam for the final D3 next week, Tuesday, yeah. Wednesday. And they had pricing in there. So it was talking about what the cost to make a liter of in Bordeaux. So I think it was about 60 cent euro at the lowest end. And then it was for maybe a commune, it was like 2.60 euro. And for a growth, it was 16.20 euro to the cost of production. It falls under pretty similar what we would be at Stratus. So I saw that, I'm like, oh, that about adds up to what you're finding
right
at a place like this, which has meticulous attention to detail in terms of what we do in the vineyard with the yields, everything by hand picking, all gravity flow winery, aging in, you know, the highest quality French and Austrian oak barrels you can buy, amphoras. You know, an amphora typically runs you about $25,000 for an amphora, so they're not cheap. We have 9 of them. So the expenses get up there, and so it definitely rivals what you would find as a growth Bordeaux.
Is there anything more annoying than when you're studying for your WSET, just figuring out all the Italian varietals? I feel like as we're doing this interview, there's going to be another grape come out.
So I just started getting in Italy last night in my studies. I made my way through all of France, which was the south of France. It was hard to get through that. I don't know, it just didn't excite me for some reason, even though I love those wines. But just reading about it, it was like on and on and on and on and on. I'm like, holy shit, this is taking a long time just on the south of France. And then don't forget about Germany, because that's a whole other category. You know, I was in Austria last year, so I feel like I got Austria down pat. I spent a week and a half in Austria. But Germany, Germany and Italy, oh my God. And then they got China in there. I haven't even, you know, that's like at the end of the book now. I'm like, well, I still got it. That's all. There's so many wine regions. I've been doing wine for so long that you know, I spent a lot of time in Portugal. I can just probably skip those chapters and it'll be fine. But China, I couldn't even, if you quiz me right now, I couldn't tell you a single thing about Chinese wine.
Beyond like sport over idols is really, is really what they're,
but the regions and
yeah. All that, I couldn't tell. I interviewed a Chinese winemaker once years ago. So that's the only reason I,
so come, I think that'll hit me by Sunday night. I'll probably finally reach China. So ask me again next Monday and I should be an expert.
Sure. All right. You know, I wasn't even going to do this. Do you have a great story of blind tasting glory and a story of blind tasting complete embarrassment? Wait, I called that that?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I'm not sure if I have any blind taste. Like, there's been times where I called wines, but it's like on to the next kind of thing. I'm not trying. I've seen other. I'm always impressed by other people's blind tasting. I guess if when I do well in blind tasting, it's maybe just expected, or I don't even put much thought to it. But I've seen winemakers like Peter Gamble is particularly who I've tasted a lot with, amazing blind taster. And I've seen him, you know, I put random things in blends that we've tasted with, and he'd be like, "Is there some Viognier in this red blend?" And it's like 2%. I'm like,
Jesus,
how the fuck did he get that?
Yeah,
like, and it's like there was no. It was just I threw that in there. Like, anyways, so I've been more impressed by other people saying things. Because I'm always like, I like to throw some wrenches in there. Thomas Batchelder does that a lot. He loves blind tasting and throw. And so I've always seen him do that. And I'm like, ooh, I like doing that too. I like challenging people more than probably I challenge myself. And then in terms of calling out the wrong things, shit, I do that all the time. You know what I mean? I like to taste wines and I like to drink wines, but I travel a lot for wine. And so I never, a lot of somms might be in a place and they really focus on their portfolio. And so they get really good at being able to name certain varieties or regions or in within their portfolio. I'm too all over the place. Like I'll do a trip to Portugal and Spain and the next year I'm in Austria and then Northern Italy. And it's like, you're in such different areas. It's so hard to come back and nail those varieties again.
By the way, I wish you all the best. I remember doing my W set for like a decade ago now. So
it's well, so far so good. Everything else has passed. So I just got to get through this D3 and then I'm done, but we'll see.
I think also just one thing people should realize is, and it's something over the last 5 years I've really noticed, is just how good this area is at full bodied wines. You can convince a skeptic to not just be about Ontario Chardonnay, that the Pinot Noirs and the Gamays can work because, hey, you know, we're a cooler climate, those grapes do it. But between like you guys, Palatine, Cassaba, Southbrook, Carlo Estate, and Peck, so it's not obviously not the exact same thing. Like it's one thing I've certainly discovered is just so many, there's so many more big full-bodied red options, and especially coming from like Niagara-on-the-Lake and St. David's in these areas.
There's an evolution that's happened before people's eyes in Niagara that most people don't even recognize. You had winemakers like JL who came in the 70s and 80s, emigrating winemakers who brought all these techniques, knowledge, things like that into Niagara. And that was the first start. They probably didn't know the terroir as well. They certainly learned it over the years, but they came in seeing, you know, blank slate and some potential. And then, you know, Niagara College and Brock started in 96 and 99 or 2000, but the two are close to each other. And now you've seen this whole other evolution that there's the beginning winemakers, the emigrating winemakers who mentored everyone through. And now almost all of Niagara are homegrown winemakers. They've been educated. They've been living there their whole lives. They know the land. They know the place. And they have mentors like JL. Like I look at my class of 2011, Nick is a winemaker in Eskilla, and Chantal, the winemaker councilman. Jess is the winemaker at Taz. Phil is the winemaker at La Closure Den. Every one of them has had amazing mentors ahead of them, but they're all homegrown, educated and learned right here. And so it's amazing, like these two generations working together and then passing the torch off and the mentorship and then the education here has led this region to just flourish like in an unbelievable way. And I've given talks that any wine region, you're not a real wine region until you have your own education system there, until you have your own university, your own research going on in that region. And that is what really exploded Niagara wine. Once we started doing our own research and making our own graduates, there's no stopping the Niagara region now because the world is whatever we want it to be.
As we end this, what excites you for the future? Not just, you know, this current vintage coming up, but what excites you?
Well, I think right now the times really are, you know, a bi-Canadian sentiment that's going on. So what really excites me, I've been doing this 15 years. I've been to my fair share of winemaker dinners where people are, you know, saying, oh, this is the first time I've had a Canadian wine since 1985, which, you know, really turned me off of it back then. And so we were really one tasting, one dinner at a time, converting a lot of consumers back to Niagara who had maybe a negative opinion from 30, 40 years ago. And now suddenly there's this new wave where everyone's just like accepting it. And they're going out there and they're being curious and trying Niagara again, and that's reopening their mind. So I'm really excited for, you know, Ontario and for Canada, you know, in general, to really move towards this sort of buy Canadian identity. And I think it's going to really benefit Niagara wines as we get consumers who were skeptical before have a new reason. It's not the reason maybe I would want for them to just, you know, want wine for that, for whatever. But we'll take whatever win we can.
The lovely unintended consequence of a pretty crazy economic policy south of the border may lead to more people open to trying your blends.
And what's great is that the Canadian brand itself is getting, like, talked about all around the world right now with all this. So even if you go down to the U.S., you know, or you go to Europe, it's like Canada is suddenly in people's minds. And so you go down and say you have Canadian wine, people used to be like, I don't understand, you know, what's the point of Canadian wine? Now they're like, oh yeah, Canada, we hear about you all the time. Canada's in the news every day. And so it's kind of funny, the Canadian brand is actually getting an uplift from all this. And hopefully we continue to be, you know, respectful in the way we do everything. And that it just shows like how smart we are in Canada and how, you know, determined we are to be a successful country.
Dean, thanks so much for doing this. It's a great story. Just hide and seek at wineries as a kid, going to school for it, coming here 2015, you know, overcoming the imposter syndrome, and now making, you know, just such a massive portfolio of impressive wines here at Stratus. And, you know, say it again, everyone out there, if you're traveling, if you're doing wine tourism, you got to come to Stratus. We're sitting here. It's gorgeous. Massive patio overlooking everything, you know, the vines and stuff, and just gorgeous weather. And yeah, I appreciate you taking time to do the pod today.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. And if anyone stops by, please make sure to say hello. And we're always happy to welcome everyone here at Stratus. Hospitality is our number one game here. So thank you for the time, and it's been a fantastic interview.
Nice. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me Apple, iTunes, iHeartRadio app, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.